Hello, this is Wendy Bauer with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated January 15th, 2018. We will begin today's reading with the breaking news on the front page. Dozens of accidents reported. Drivers urged to stay home unless absolutely necessary. From Decatur, after more than a dozen accidents Monday morning, police are urging caution to drivers. Motorists should not travel unless absolutely necessary, the Illinois State Police said Monday. Police were on the scene of more than 12 accidents on Interstate 55 and Interstate 72 before 8 a.m. Motorists are urged to use extreme caution, as there is still many slick areas on the interstates, according to the statement. Between 1 and 3 inches of snow fell overnight throughout central Illinois. On Monday, wind chill values could be between -7 and 3, and on Tuesday they could range from -7 to -17, the Weather Service said. Both days will also be windy, with gusts as high as 24 miles per hour on Monday and 18 miles per hour on Tuesday. The weather is expected to warm up later in the week, with highs in the 40s on Saturday and Sunday. But that doesn't mean it'll be a good time to go outside, as Sunday's forecast also calls for rain. The recent snowfall is an anomaly for this winter. James Auten, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Lincoln, acknowledged there's been less than usual and no snowstorms predicted in the last few weeks, but said people should remain alert and safe. It's still winter, and even though it's going to warm up toward the end of this week, winter is still here, he said. Don't be surprised if we get some heavier snows in the next 6 weeks or something. We still could. Never let your guard down when it comes to winter weather. And moving to the front page, Donette Beckett's column, Together Decatur. This is a brush with relaxation. Painting parties offer stress relief, creative outlet. From Decatur. The art class has grown up and is looking to socialize. Decatur area businesses and organizations have latched onto so-called painting parties, in which participants gather at a club, restaurant, banquet hall, or any place with tables and decent lighting. But these are not lessons in brush techniques, chiaroscuro shading, or how to mix pigments. Rather, the goal is simple: to have fun. It is cathartic and a good stress reliever, said Liz Swartout, who created Let's Paint with Liz nearly 4 years ago. Groups hire businesses like Swartout's. Some use the events as fundraisers or bonding activities with employees. Even to-be brides are inviting friends to them for bachelorette parties. Elizabeth Van Houten McDermott, owner of Paint Like Me, began her business in 2012. She supplies the paint, materials, and 8x10-inch canvases. She teaches mixed media techniques, which include paint, glitter, tools, or metallics. Throughout the years, McDermott has gained a following among Decatur residents. Painters may have a meal with their friends, then gather in a meeting room to show their creative side. People like to come right after work, eat first, then have a couple of drinks while they are painting, McDermott said. Everybody says how relaxing it is. The average price to participate is $25. During Swarthouse parties, painters usually create wood signs, often seen during the holidays or for decorations. She's found the paintings are popular because they can be displayed by the artist from year to year. Even children's parties have been organized. For the kids, it may be a little bit easier subject matter, McDermott said. She said the model works because while there is widespread interest in art, the ability to get the supplies isn't always there. They just don't want to go buy all the stuff, McDermott said. Paint Like Me parties can accommodate up to 150 people. Topics vary from movie series and barns to holidays and seasons. With the combination of private parties and open parties, painting businesses can host 4 to 5 gatherings a week. Swarthout's job at the party is to give direction, but I also let them do whatever they want as well, she said. I've had people do the total opposite of what I was doing. That helps them be creative and have fun. Painting is only part of the fun. Joanne Pellegrino has attended so many Paint Like Me parties, she has a frequent painter card. Paint six times and your 7th is free, she said. She attends the painting parties because it is a fun time with her friends. It also makes you feel like you are really talented, said Cindy Baker. Carrie Holderby compared the evening to a night out, but without the alcohol. And I don't drink, she said, but it is a good time with my friends. Everyone paints the same picture, but they don't have to worry about competing with the people sitting next to them. They will make you a good artist, Pellegrino said about the hosts. Lisa Pope attends painting parties for what she calls girls' time. The mother of 3 spends a couple of hours during the class relaxing and creating something she made herself. I paint and cover and paint and cover, she said. It is a stress reliever, especially if I can do it without little people interacting with me. Donette Beckett's Together Decatur column notes, if you know a person or a story that exemplifies the best of Decatur, contact Donette Beckett at 217-421-6983 or dbeckett@heraldreview.com. And from the Illinois Bicentennial column, modern retail born in Illinois. From mail order to brick and mortar, Sears led the way. As the home of Sears since the late 19th century, Illinois is the birthplace of modern retail. Even today's colossus, Amazon, can trace the roots of its business model to Sears' original mail order business that popularized the notion of buying products at home without first seeing and touching them in person. There were some small mail order companies before, but Sears became the largest, the most successful, the giant, said Libby Mahoney, senior curator of the Chicago History Museum. And if it seems strange that such a retailer could grow strong enough to make its headquarters the tallest building in the world, as Sears did in Chicago in 1973, consider today's intense competition among cities to house Amazon's second headquarters, she said. It was Chicago's central position in the nation's railroad and highway networks that made it a better place for Richard Sears to operate the mail order watch company he'd started in Minneapolis the previous year, 1886. In Chicago, Sears partnered with watchmaker Alva C. Roebuck, leading to the longtime name of the firm being Sears Roebuck & Company. Its first catalog, featuring only watches and jewelry, was published in 1888, while its first large catalog of general merchandise came along in 1896. Sears wooed customers with promises of savings gained by eliminating the middleman. It popularized the money-back guarantee to build trust with the consumer, Mahoney said. The gradual diversification of the company's products seemed to know no bounds, perhaps best illustrated by the advent of Sears Modern Homes. Between 1908 and 1940, Sears sold about 75,000 such homes around the country by mail order. Many of the homes, which came in 447 different designs, exist today. Such a company at that time was largely dependent on the U.S. Postal Service for its success and reliability, Mahoney said. But eventually, Sears Roebuck's original mail order business began to be threatened by the greater urbanization of the country after World War I. The solution, championed by then Vice President and future company president Robert E. Wood, was the introduction of brick-and-mortar stores in the 1920s. Many other innovations followed under Wood's guidance, including getting into the insurance business during the Great Depression and the creation of Allstate Insurance. Like several other Sears-created brands, Allstate eventually would be spun off as an independent company, but not until 1993. Although Sears has never been a manufacturer, its brands such as Craftsman Tools, Kenmore Appliances, and Die Hard Batteries helped build the company's reputation. Even as the biggest of all, Sears didn't take customer loyalty for granted, Mahoney said. They were really trying to improve the appearance of their products and make them stylish in the 1930s, Mahoney said. I think they were really savvy merchants. The nation's economic recovery after World War II was what enabled such imitators as Kmart, Target, and Kohl's, but probably not until the 1970s or 1980s did they start to have a significant impact on Sears' business, Mahoney said. Even in the mail-order years, Chicago-based Montgomery Ward was the country's distant second-place retailer, despite having started earlier. Sears always seemed to have the upper hand, Mahoney said. Nevertheless, Montgomery Ward's successfully carved a niche for itself by deliberately selling different products than Sears did, she added. For the past 25 years, Sears has made its home at the 780-acre Prairie Stone Business Park it created on the west side of Hoffman Estates. Though the now-vanished Poplar Creek Music Theater was probably the first name that put Hoffman Estates on the regional map, Sears was an even bigger one, Mayor Bill McLeod said. When it was announced, it was a really big deal, McLeod said. Sears was an iconic retailer. It obviously brought a lot of attention to the village. Sears made a big difference. Among the other developments that have located around it are the Sears Center Arena, now home to the NBA G League's Windy City Bulls, and the Chicago region's 185,000-square-foot Cabela's store. The westward expansion of the village's commercial presence was followed by equivalent residential growth. There was very little housing on the west side of the village before Sears came, McLeod said. Though headlines today often chronicle the company's present struggles, reminders of Sears' heyday are all around. These include the call letters of Chicago radio station WLS, which stands for World's Largest Store, for the 4 years Sears owned the station in the 1920s, and the name of Schaumburg's massive Woodfield Mall, which honors both Robert Wood and iconic Chicago merchant Marshall Field. But for a business based in the greater Chicago area for more than 130 years, Sears' longevity and influence are historic, Mahoney said. They've hung on longer than the stockyards, she laughed. And this column notes that this weekly Illinois Bicentennial series is sponsored by the Illinois Associated Press Media Editors and Illinois Press Association. More than 20 newspapers are creating stories about the state's history, places, and key moments in advance of the bicentennial on December 3, 2018. Stories published up to this date can be found at 200illinois.com. And next, from the front page, candidates looking to break away. 8 Democrats in hunt to be next Attorney General. With early voting just weeks away, the Democratic candidates vying for a shot to replace Attorney General Lisa Madigan are raising millions of dollars, crisscrossing Illinois, and touting endorsements. 8 Democrats are trying to stand out from the crowded field, despite similar views and promises to fight President Donald Trump's agenda. The open race features a former governor, state legislators, a police reform leader, a mayor, and former federal prosecutors. On the Republican side, Urbana attorney Erica Harrell, a former Miss America and past candidate for the 13th Congressional District, has establishment backing over a lesser-known county board member. Here's a look at the March 20th Democratic primary. Kwame Raoul, 53, is a Chicago State Senator. He was appointed in 2004 to replace Barack Obama, who'd been elected to the U.S. Senate. Scott Drury, 45, a Highwood state representative, swapped his gubernatorial bid for attorney general. The former federal prosecutor became a legislator in 2013. Pat Quinn, 69, assumed the governor's office from his lieutenant governor job when Rod Blagojevich was arrested on corruption charges and impeached. Quinn won office outright in 2010, but lost re-election in 2014. Sharon Fairley, 57, is a former federal prosecutor named by Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel to overhaul a police oversight organization after video of a white officer fatally shooting black teenager Laquan McDonald was publicly released. Aaron Goldstein, 42, represented Blagojevich at two corruption trials. In 2016, he won a ward committeeman post over Dick Mell, Blagojevich's father-in-law. Jesse Ruiz, 52, heads the Chicago Park District's board. He's served as the chairman of the State Board of Education and as a Chicago Board of Education vice president. Nancy Rotering, 56, is Highland Park mayor. She made an unsuccessful primary bid for the U.S. House in 2016, despite U.S. Senator Dick Durbin's endorsement. Renato Mariotti, 41, a former federal prosecutor and frequent television commentator, is making his first bid for public office. When it comes to statewide name recognition, Quinn leads. A former state treasurer, he was known for populist tactics such as walking across Illinois to promote universal health care. Since losing the governor's race to Republican Bruce Rauner, he's tried to stay in the public eye, including circulating petitions for term limits on Chicago mayor. However, Quinn doesn't have establishment backing. The Cook County Democratic Party unanimously endorsed Raoul during November slating session. Raoul has also picked up union support. Some candidates, including Drury, are casting themselves as outsiders. He was the sole Democrat last year not to vote for Mike Madigan, the father of Lisa Madigan, as House Speaker, a post he's long held. Fundraising experts say the Attorney General's race is the most closely watched statewide contest after the extensive gubernatorial election. A clearer picture will emerge with next week's fundraising disclosure deadline, but an early look shows Raoul leading with over $1.2 million raised, including donations from unions and the tobacco industry. Drury raised over $800,000, followed by Fairley and Rotering, who have over $550,000 each. Trailing them are Ruiz, Quinn, Goldstein, and Mariotti. The candidates' stances are hard to distinguish on a variety of issues, including immigrant-friendly views and supporting marijuana legalization. They call the office a last line of defense in fighting the Republican president's agenda and all pledge to do more to fight sexual harassment. There are slight differences in their goals for the office, which, through Lisa Madigan's tenure, focused on consumer rights. Rotering hopes to tackle gun violence and push an assault weapons ban. Goldstein and Drury say fighting police corruption is a priority. Fairley says Illinois has had too many career politicians. And in their words, Goldstein says, having real criminal justice reform, stopping mass incarceration, and fighting corruption. That's what I would do as Attorney General. From Mariotti, I'm running for Attorney General because we don't live in an ordinary time. We are in a crisis. We have a president who is violating our constitutional rights. From Rotering, you need to deal with public corruption. It's not a joke. It's not what our state is. This is inefficient government. From Ruiz, I want to protect our health care. I want to protect our safety and our communities. I want to protect our environment and make sure I'm an advocate for the people of Illinois. Fairly, the people of Illinois are tired of our political leaders failing to address the challenges we face, leaving our state stuck in a seemingly never-ending crisis. Raul says, the Office of Attorney General has an opportunity to direct victims' resources. I'm going to make sure the most victimized communities get those resources. Drury says, I'm not running to be a spokesperson for the machine. I'm not running to be a spokesperson for lobbyists. I'm not running to be a spokesperson for special interests. I am running for you. And finally, Quinn says, I want to be the lawyer for the people of Illinois. That's really the definition of the office. And from the local and state page, Tony Reed writes from Decatur, Corral celebrates the classics. As the Greater Decatur Corral put their hearts into singing Who Could Ask for Anything More Sunday afternoon, audience member Linda Hoog really had the answer. No one. She loved that George Gershwin number and the chorale's rendition of other classic favorites, featuring the work of fellow musical giants like Duke Ellington, Irving Berlin, and Judy Garland. The chorale's Great American Songbook two-hour concert series wrapped up a three-day run Sunday at Richland Community College's Schilling Auditorium, leaving Hoog convinced that no one would want for anything more. I like the music, I like the people, and I've followed the chorale for probably 5 or so years, said Hoog, 68, who lives in Decatur. You can see they enjoy singing, and you see it in the animation, the way they kind of dance while they sing. The price is also right. Tickets were $10 in advance, $12 at the door. And they give you a lot for your money. As a person that is over 65, I appreciate that kind of thing. Hoog brought her neighbor, Ruth Pels, along to enjoy the show, and she didn't have any problem naming her favorite number. All of them, said Pels, 94, sporting a broad smile. They were in good company, as the audience, numbering more than 370, was a sellout. The 70-strong chorale had its own ranks swollen with the guest additions of Maroa Forsyth choirs from 6th grade, 7th, and 8th grades, and high school, who sang on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, respectively. We all sing fun music, and it's music people are familiar with, by wonderful composers, said Greater Decatur Chorale Director, Conductor, Ted Hess, who met his wife, Dr. Kristen Newcomb Hess, when she showed up for a chorale audition. Auditions are coming up again at 6:30 p.m., January 29th, at the Poge Arts and Recreation Center, 2020 North Oakland Avenue. For information on requirements and preparation, call the Decatur Park District's Cultural Arts Manager, Marie Jagger-Taylor, at 217-421-6648. Jagger-Taylor said the Park District doesn't have many adult programs, but it really hit one out of the park with the creation of the chorale in 1985. It's been supported not only by the people who want to be in it, but also by the audiences, she added. To make music is to make magic. Also on the local page, police. Husband hits wife's boyfriend. From Decatur. An angry husband chased his estranged wife around her boyfriend's car Saturday night before punching the boyfriend in the head multiple times, police said. Sergeant Brian Earls with Decatur Police said the 25-year-old husband was being sought Sunday on charges of aggravated battery and vehicular invasion. Earls said that the boyfriend, 25, suffered a swollen knot on his head and bruising above his left eye. He had been punched 5 or 6 times as he sat in the car. The estranged wife was not listed as being injured. Earls said the boyfriend had driven her over to the husband's house in the 1900 block of North Gebhard Court to get some money when the incident happened about 8:30 p.m. And from the dialogue page, Leonard Pitts writes, Dr. King's words still ring true. A few words on the difficulty of voting while black. As we mark what would have been his 89th birthday, it seems fitting to recall that Martin Luther King spoke to that difficulty in a 1957 speech, whose words ring relevant 61 years later. All types of conniving methods are still being used to prevent Negroes from becoming registered voters, lamented King. As he saw it, neither political party was blameless. He castigated Democrats for capitulating to the rabid racists of their southern wing, the so-called Dixiecrats, and blasted Republicans for caving in to right-wing reactionary northerners. Both political parties, he said, have betrayed the cause of justice. While there are no more Dixiecrats and the right-wing reactionaries to whom the GOP kowtows are more likely to be found in the South and Midwest now than in the North, it is noteworthy that King's central point remains valid. Neither party covers itself with glory where African Americans are concerned. To the contrary, African American issues, police reform, job discrimination, mass incarceration, routinely go unaddressed by both. And here, someone will demand to know how it is if both parties share blame, black voters remain overwhelmingly loyal to one of them, reliably casting about 90% of their presidential ballots for Democrats. But it isn't that hard to understand. Imagine you have two suitors. One of them tends to ignore you, often seems ashamed to be seen with you, but occasionally brings you flowers. The other beats you. If you must date one, is it any wonder you'd choose the former? So Republicans who pioneered the Southern strategy opened the 1980 election praising states' rights, demonized Willie Horton, gutted the Voting Rights Act, issued coded appeals to white racial resentment, demeaned the first African-American president, and were hit just last year by federal judges for a photo ID law designed with surgical precision to stop black North Carolinians from voting, have no standing to ask black people, why don't you like us? Unfortunately, the GOP's resort to these conniving methods has left Democrats no meaningful competition for the black vote, and where competition is absent, neglect invariably flourishes. Although they occasionally come bearing flowers, such as Barack Obama's quiet dismantling of the war on drugs, Democrats are far too likely to ignore black issues, or, at best, pay lip service to them. And they are forever stepping over black voters while giving the high sign to white ones, like a married woman winking and mouthing, "Call me," to some other woman while his wife is standing there. And we'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, January 15th, 2018. Please stay tuned.